I would like to introduce our main speaker of the evening, R.B. from O.B.
I'm Rob, I'm an alcoholic.
Is this a pinch pint?
I met a new guy recently, and I was asking him if he ever got a pinch pint, and he said, "What's a pinch pint?" And I had to explain it to him. You know, when you're in a pinch, and you don't have enough money for a whole pint, you get a half pint.
Anyway, this kind of reminded me of a pinch pint. So.
That probably doesn't amuse you, but it amuses me. Anyway, I'm sure glad to be here, and I'm glad to be sober, and I want to thank Larry for asking me to come and talk for this group, and I've been watching Larry for the last few years, and I've been trying to figure him out. You know, Larry's one of these guys that he came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was really, really eager. And so I'm trying to decide one of two things in my mind. Either he's really, really full of you-know-what, or he's really, really desperate. And I think it's been the latter, because I've watched him get busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I want to thank you for asking me to come, and I know that you take a lot of pride in this group. You've been talking about this group and how much you like this group and how much you are committed to this group. So I feel very welcome here, and thank you, Larry, for asking me to come and talk. I also want to thank my wife, Gail, and one of her sponsees, Charlene, for coming and supporting me tonight. I couldn't get any of the guys that I sponsored. Boy, they've had about enough of me. Welcome those that introduced themselves to new as being new to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new and you didn't introduce yourself, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that you find what I found here, which is a way out. You know, a way out from that hell that goes along with me drinking. You know, I have a sobriety date. It's November 13th, 1987. I have a home group at Cedar Street Men's, and I got a sponsor, and his name is Griff, and he's a tall, handsome fellow. He always likes me to say that. But I think if you are new, those are three things that I would really kind of strongly encourage you to get is a home group that you can get committed to, someone that you can follow around, and get a date that you really, really are committed to. So I have those three things, and I also have, with my wife here tonight, I really want to thank Gail for coming and supporting me. We do a lot of AA stuff separate, and we do a lot of AA stuff together. And I just ran into an old a friend I hadn't seen in a long time. Woo, that was close. Michelle. And she asked us, how long have you and Gail been married now? And this year will be 19 years of being married. And I don't know if that impresses you, but that sure impresses the hell out of me. You know, because I didn't have relationships that lasted 19 hours when I was drinking. I don't know. It's like, for some reason, the bedwetting was kind of a turnoff. And I'm a drunk, you know. And I wish I was. Sometimes I kind of, you know, when you know, yeah, you, and I haven't wet the bed since I got sober. Isn't that right? And I wish I had a story where I robbed banks or I stole cars or I've been to penitentiary, but really that's not my, you know, my experience. I mean, I was just a drunk, you know, I was just a drunk. And I've had, and being a little over 24 years sober, I've got twice as much experience in Alcoholics Anonymous as an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous than I do drinking liquor. But in order to qualify, I need to let you know that I drank liquor. God, I love the effect produced by alcohol. You know, I really did. And so it's kind of a
funny that you'd ask me to even tell my story. I mean, I wasn't even really there. I drank and I got sober relatively young. And if you're young and you're getting sober, they usually say things to you like, you know, I spilt more than you drank. And that's what they tell me. My standard comeback when they told me that was, if you did more swilling and less spilling, you could have got here sooner. You know, the other thing that really, really got me is whenever I was brand new is they would always say things, gosh, Sonny, I sure wish I could have got sober when I was young like you. And I used to just think, God, I wish I could have paced myself. But I'm just a piggy. I'm just a piggy. And I really identify with that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous when it talks about that phenomenon of craving. And that old phenomenon of craving really kicked in pretty early with me. I had my first, I grew up in an alcoholic home, but I don't think that makes me alcoholic. You know, my father died when I was 9 years old, and I got really, really mad at God, didn't want any part of that. And I don't think that makes me alcoholic. You know, I was adopted as an infant, and I don't think that makes me alcoholic, you know. Those are just things that happened to me prior to finding liquor. Drinking liquor made me alcoholic. And my first drink was just an amazing experience for me. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. You know, and with my father dying when I was 9 years old, I think probably the most difficult years in my life was probably between the years of 9 and 14, 13, 14. And that's because I didn't have, I always felt just a little bit less than, different than, apart from. You hear that a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I just felt like something was missing. And at 14, and so it was difficult till I found alcohol. My first solution for alcoholism was booze. Well, it was first was malt liquor, but, you know, I worked up to booze. You know, because whenever I found alcohol, I found something that provided me a certain ease and comfort. I found something that really, really worked for me. You know, my first meaningful drink, I was 14 years old. I was going to a junior high dance. I was going to have to ask girls to dance, and I was absolutely terrified. And me and my little buddy down at Ocean Beach got some bum down at Pat's Liquor to buy us 2 quarts of Old English 800. And someone's big brother gave us some low-grade marijuana. And I drank that malt liquor and I smoked that joint, and I tell you what, I asked girls to dance and I had the time. And I had the time of my life, you know. It was a time of my life where I was a skinny little kid, long stringy hair. It was the 70s, and when I drank that malt liquor, man, I was bulletproof. I loved the effect it produced. And I ended up getting sick that night because I drank more than my buddy, and I ended up throwing up. And I woke up the next morning with my first hangover, but not with the thought of, I don't want to do that again. I woke up with the thought of, I can't wait till I get to do that again, because I love the effect produced by alcohol. You know, and I was off and running. I was just off and running. You know, and I drank every chance I could get after that. You know, and growing up in Ocean Beach in the 70s, I never smoked or sniffed or popped a outside issue, but I sure tried a lot of drugs. You know, because as a kid growing up in the 70s down in Ocean Beach, I mean, you know, it was easier to get other substances sometimes than it was to get liquor. You know, and so. I used a lot of different other things kind of growing up to try to treat that what I've come to understand as my alcoholism. But it always started and ended with booze for me. You know, and certain drugs quit working for me. But booze always worked for me. And I'd like to tell you that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because booze quit working for me. Booze didn't quit working for me. Booze just did way more to me than it did for me. And because my last drink worked for me too, and I'll get around to that. You know, but that that experience with alcohol was so positive that I found myself looking forward to the opportunity to drink that any time that I could. And I tried all kinds of other different substances growing up in that time frame down in Ocean Beach. And, you know, by the time I was in high school, I had pretty much lost interest in a lot of other activities other than drinking and partying. And by the time I was in high school, my mother was convinced that Ocean Beach was the problem. You know, you can take the kid out of Ocean Beach, but you can't take Ocean Beach out of the kid. Ocean Beach wasn't the problem. I was the problem. You know, because shortly after I started drinking, I started having blackouts. You know, and as a kid growing up in Ocean Beach back in that time, I mean, one of my first treatment plans for alcoholism was this little thing called Cross Tops. You know, because you get a rack of them for like $10, and I could drink a whole bottle of Tyrolia after I had some of those. Spinata, whatever we can find. I mean, I was just a garbage pail kid. I mean, you gotta be to get here at that age. And so I used substances every time I could. I became a blackout drinker. I tried a lot of those methods of control that the guy talked about in chapter 3. You know, one of them I never tried though. I've never agreed to resign if ever found drunk on the job. Never did that. But I did once agree to resign because I couldn't drink on the job. I was digging ditches and it was hot and I said, I need a beer. The guy says, you can't drink on the job. I said, I gotta go. You know, but I tried all those methods of control and my first drink was malt liquor. I kind of progressed and I love drinking tequila. God, I love tequila. But I could go from being the life of the party to wrecking a party drinking tequila. And I would do crazy, tragic things, you know, with tequila. So I had to switch. I had to quit drinking tequila. And I switched to rum. You know, and rum did terrible things to my insides. And so I switched to vodka. You know, and I love vodka. I see today they got all... I listen, you know, and I watch TV sometimes and I release these things. They've got like... Oh, man, they've got nice-looking vodka these days, you know. They got flavored vodka and special vodka and expensive vodka. I just like cheap vodka. Smirnoff, Kamchatka. There was this stuff you could get down at Mayfair Market down in Ocean Beach back in the day called Winner's Circle. Huh? It made for Winner's Circle vodka. Yeah, it had a little pony and a horseshoe on it. That's lucky vodka right there, and cheap too, and it got the job done, you know. But by the time I was a teenager, I was just a mess. I really was, and my mom, God rest her soul, she said, you know, you just need to get out of Ocean Beach. And I didn't have a real good plan. And I graduated from high school and I made a decision after high school that college wasn't for me. So I decided to just move away. And this was my first series of geographics. So I decided I was going to move away and become a ski bum. And I became half of that. You guess which half. You know, because in geographics, they'll tell you geographics don't work, but they do, you know. They work all right, you know. You move to a new place, and you get some new friends, and you start over, and you get a fresh start, and you haven't, like, peed in anybody's closet or puked on anybody's coffee table, and, you know, so they think, hey, he's a pretty good guy. You know, and then the next thing you know, I mean, you know, because I have this phenomenon of craving, things start happening and I start, you know, drinking more than I intend and doing things I don't intend to do, and it catches up to me. It just always caught up with me. You know, so I moved up and became a ski bum for a couple years, and I came back to San Diego, and I kind of slid into the family business. My uncle used to have a little rental yard down on Midway Drive called Poor Boys Rentals, and I love Poor Boys Rentals, and I love working at Poor Boys Rentals. I love the characters there. My uncle had all these guys working for him, and they all had nicknames, and I mean, there was Captain Zigzag and Tennessee and Wild Man Walt and Indian George, and you know, I thought these guys were cool. They were losers. But I just wanted to be like those guys, and they taught me a lot of things. I learned from those guys. They taught me how to drink in the morning to get over drinking from the night before. You know, and being the boss's nephew, I just kind of had to step in line. I was just a kid, you know, as a teenager working down there with a lot of these guys, and God rest their souls. They're probably long and gone, but they, you know, I mean, that was kind of where I ended up. And I did that for a while, and the family kind of bailed me out, and I ended up kind of, on my next series of geographics as I moved to Hawaii to become a surf bum. And I became half of that. You see, there's a theme here. You can be a sober bum too. You know, I had a guy I had a guy that I was working with. I said, "You're a bum." He says, "Why do you call me that?" I says, "Well, bums don't work." He said, "You've been around AA for a couple of years now. You need to get." And he didn't even want to look for a job. He said, "You're an insensitive sponsor." And I says, "That's okay." I'm usually not that mean, but he kind of got to me anyway. He's capable of working. But I became like a bum again, you know, and I ended up over in Hawaii on my next geographic, and I found some. This is where I really got that drinking rum. Over there they had this kind of rum. You could buy this rum called Royal Hawaiian for $3.99 a quart, light or dark. And it was cheap, and it was rot gut, and it got the job done. And, you know, I lived over there for a little while, and I forgot to look for a job, though, because I told you I became kind of a bum. And so I ended up back in San Diego, where I ended up getting done drinking, you know. And, you know, I got done drinking when I was 26 years old. I came back to San Diego, and I just kept drinking, and I started being really more blackouts, more crazy stuff. I became, I'd pretty much drink beer all day, and then I'd switch to liquor at night. And you know, I never got fired from a job in my life. You know, I always knew when the heat was on, and then it's time to move on. And by the time I was 26 years old, I had had a series of kind of events take place in my life where I was just out of excuses, and I was working for a company called Hornblower Party Yachts. Sounds like a good job. I mean, I just basically like paint and varnished and fixed the boats, and I'd ran out of excuses, and I called my boss one morning, and I said, you know, I'm not coming in today. And he said, well, what is it this time? And I told him the truth. I said, I've been doing cocaine and I'm drinking vodka, and I've been doing that for 3 days now. And he says, do you think you might come in tomorrow? And I said, uh-uh. And I hung up that phone, and I thought, oh, my gosh, what did I just do? But I was just, the game was up, man. I had no more excuses. I couldn't remember if I'd had two grandmas die, you know, or one grandma die. You know, I didn't have any more lies. I couldn't make any more excuses for my drinking. I just knew that the kind of the gig was up, but I hung up that phone, and I went looking for help, and I couldn't find any help. I'm glad I didn't find any help, because I needed that last month of drinking to get done drinking. And in that last month of drinking, things happened to me that I never thought could happen to me. You know, when I read that the big book and that chapter of Vision for You, and it talks about the end days of our drinking, you know, in the end days, you know, those old memories were gone. You know, and then those hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this will understand. I understood that, because in that last month of my drinking, it just got really, really desperate, and a lot of really crazy stuff happened to me. I started throwing up blood on a regular basis. You know, I you know, if it was a good night, you know, I would make sure that I would try to pop a can of beer and set it somewhere so first thing in the morning I could get the flat beer down. And some of you understand why you need a. I even talked to a kid. He didn't understand. He says, "Why would you drink flat beer in the morning?" You know, I mean, when it isn't staying down, it's easier to come up if it's flat. And in the end of my drinking, it wasn't staying down. I was throwing up blood on a pretty regular basis. I was pretty sick. You know, and on those mornings when it wasn't good, I mean, I'd go searching around and I would go through empties and pull cigarette butts out of them and get myself a drink to take that edge off so that I could get going one more day. It was crazy. I don't ever want to forget that. It ain't pretty. You know, I mean, I see those things now, you know, I see those pretty little flavored vodka and all the other stuff, and my mind goes, oh, man, that's nice. But I got to remember what it was like in those end days of drinking. I got to remember what it's like to throwing up bile, wondering if am I going to choke to death this time? Because it's coming out my mouth and the nose at the same time, and all I want to do is just get a drink down so I can get about my day. And it ain't working. That's what the end days of my drinking was like. It wasn't pretty. You know, and something happened at the end of that month, and it was somewhere around the end of October, beginning of November of 1987. And I had somehow ended up at a place where some guys had been up for an extended period of time, and I was drinking, and there was a knock on the door. And the one guy was told to come down to the parking lot. And I heard the word, I heard cops. And so I tried to escape. And what happened was I got beat into a state of reasonableness by the narcotics task force and alcoholism. And in handcuffs, I had a moment of clarity. And in that moment of clarity, I just said, God, I can't live like this anymore. And I haven't lived like that since. And I didn't even know I was praying. And I didn't know who I was crying out to. But they drug me back up to this place. And I, when you try to escape and the guys with the big yellow jackets come and they got their flashlights and their nightsticks, it's probably best you just hit the deck. And I didn't hit the deck in time. So I literally got beat up. And I remember, you know, and I'd like to tell you that that was my last drink, but it wasn't. But I had that moment of clarity and I said, you know, God, I can't live like this anymore. And I haven't lived like that since. Eventually, they kind of interrogated me and they let me go. They said, why are you here? Are you a drug dealer? I'm not a drug dealer. They said, well, you know, you have outstanding warrants for your arrest. By all right, we ought to take you to jail. I mean, nothing big. I mean, let's see. You know, one DUI, driving on a suspended license. I mean, failures to appear for just being kind of a derelict. That's all I had. I mean, he said, but you have outstanding warrants for your arrest. We ought to take you to jail. I said, take me. The gig was up. They didn't take me. You know, but I left there that night, and all I did was I went back to Mayfair Market and I bought myself a pint of vodka. I drank it. And somehow I got a little shut eye. And I woke up, and that wasn't my last drink. Because I woke up the next morning and I had the shakes real bad. And I went down to Sea Trader Liquor on Point Loma Avenue in Ocean Beach, Sunset Cliffs area, and a place that I used to frequent. And I ordered two tall cans of beer. And I sat on the bench and I drank it. And I'd like to tell you at that point that alcohol quit working for me, but that alcohol worked for me just like the first drink worked for me. It provided me a temporary sense of ease and comfort. It made this go away. You know, but after I had those two drinks, I made a call to a friend of the family and an aunt and uncle that still was kind of concerned about me. And they sent a friend of the family over, this old timer by the name of Big Ed. He was a retired firefighter that I'd known since I was a kid. And he said, I'm coming over, kid. I'm taking you to a meeting. I said, what kind of meeting? He said, Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, you sure it's anonymous?
Now, I'm a well-known drunk, but I don't want to be an anonymous alcoholic. I don't want anyone seeing me there. He says, it's anonymous. I walk into my first meeting, and there are three people that I knew there, and they said, hey, we're glad to see you, Robbie. We've been saving you a seat. Keep coming back. Oh, God, I wasn't happy to see them. You know, but I'm happy to see you guys tonight. So if you're new and people are saying, hey, we're glad you're here, you're the most important person in here, and you feel like lower than, you know, welcome. I mean, but I wasn't happy to see them, but because it was weird. I thought it was, I didn't know how you guys could help me with my problems. And I ran into this guy, and he, after the meeting, he kind of cornered me, and he had me walk out to his truck, and he said, I have something for you. And I thought he was going to give me a business card, because I thought if I could get a job, a girl, a place to live, and some better transpo, I'd be good to go. Because I'm like one of those little punch-em things. When you punch it, it keeps coming back up. I was like that. So I just kept bouncing back up. But, you know, he said to me something that I thought was so bizarre. He gave me that book that Debbie read out of, and thank you, Debbie, for reading out of the book. He handed me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, if you can learn how not to drink it a day at a time, all your problems will solve themselves. And I thought, what a sap. You know? But he was telling me the truth. You know, but I needed a place of recuperation. So I, the next morning I kind of got into, after I ended up in a facility where I got the cobwebs cleared, and when I got the cobwebs cleared, they pointed out something to me that I had neglected to see, and that was I basically had nowhere to go. And I had a 68 Ford pickup with one headlight and one window that I hotwired to get around in. I was about to be physically evicted from the apartment that I was living in. I hotwired my vehicle because I was tired of losing the keys. I lost the keys all the time. I got through the place through the cat door when I needed to get in and out. And the landlord wanted me out because I hadn't been paying the rent, and the power had been turned off, and it was time to go. And so they pointed out to me something at this place of recuperation, that the best option for a guy like me was to accept a voluntary commitment to a long-term institution for homeless alcoholic men. And I ended up living at Pathfinders. And, you know, and how's a nice kid from a nice little community, beach community, going to end up in Golden Hills with all those stumble bumps? You know? I remember, I remember this, and I tell this story because this, I believe that, you know, my understanding is a God that I don't always understand sometimes does things and puts people in my life to work, you know, just at the right time. And I ended up at Pathfinders, and I was on restriction, and this other resident comes up to me, and his name was William, and he had no teeth, and he said, are you new guy in the house? I said, pardon me? He said, are you a new guy? I said, yeah, I'm the new guy. He says, want to go to the door? I said, what? He said, you want to go to the door? He says, you're the new guy. I've been here a while. You can go to the door with me. And next thing you know, I'm walking around Golden Hills with this old street bum. I'm a beach drunk, you know. I'm not a street bum. But I talked to this guy, and he had, I to this day, I still remember William. He had, he had steel blue eyes. And I started talking to this man. And he told me he was 52 years old, and he'd been living on the streets for 15 years. And he took me to the store. And as we were going through the store and down the aisles of this grocery store, he said, you see lemon extract? I said, yeah, I see lemon extract. He says, got more alcohol than vanilla. And he says, it goes down pretty good with bubble up. And I says, why do I need to know that?
He says, because when you're living on the streets, kid, he says, they'll keep you away from the booze. He says, but they don't keep you away from the spice rack. At that moment, I could think one of two things. Either I'm not like this person, I don't belong here, but he looked at me with those blue eyes and I saw me. And I knew that I was more afraid of going where he'd been than he was afraid of going back, because 2 days later he was gone. I don't know. At least that's the way I remember it. I just knew that the gig was up. You know, so I ended up at Pathfinders, and I ended up eventually kind of getting a sponsor and taking the steps. The first power that I tapped into, I had a lot of problems with God when I got here, and the first power I tapped into was the group. And those grumpy old dudes in AA from Pathfinders, you know, and they tell me things like, there's only two things you need to know about God. There is one and it ain't you. And I thought, man. But I devised a plan to get thrown out of AA. I told them I was going to use the ocean as my higher power. It was a power greater than myself. It provided my life meaning and purpose. I can touch it. I can feel it when I'm in it. I'm living in the moment. It works for me. And those guys just said, we're glad you found a higher power, kid. Keep coming back. You know, and eventually they read the book Alcoholics Anonymous to me, and I found out what the problem was. See, the solution doesn't help until you figure out what the problem is. I knew I was alcoholic, but I didn't know what being an alcoholic meant until someone read the book Alcoholics Anonymous with me, and I identified with Bill's story. And I identified with that phenomenon of craving in the doctor's opinion. And I identified with that insanity that precedes the first drink and more about alcoholism. You know? And that one little paragraph that you read in italics, and these guys used to say things, well, you know, back then, in order, if they put it in italics, they had to change the typeset. That means it's important and you ought to pay attention. You know, and one time a guy was there, he was reading the big book to us. I mean, you know, like, I can't read. He's reading it to us, and he gets to that point, and he said, how many of you, and a bunch of guys sitting around a table in an institution for homeless alcoholic men, and the facilitator of the big book study says, how many of you choose not to drink today? And we all raised our hand, and he says, why are you living here? He says, if you can just simply choose not to drink, why are you living here? And it really kind of, that little experience helped me understand. It's like, you know, how many times did I choose to not drink? And I drank. Somewhere along the line, I lost the power of choice and drank. You know, Bill and his wisdom, or his wordsmith, I mean, he calls it so many different things. I mean, I get into this stuff. What's the difference between a peculiar mental twist, a curious mental phenomenon, a strange mental blank spot, or the insanity that precedes the first drink? I don't think there is any difference. It just doesn't make sense. Why we would continue to go back and take that first drink whenever we know we have that phenomenon of craving. But I did that desperate experiment of the first drink over and over and over until I was convinced that I was 100% powerless over alcohol. And when I was 100% powerless over alcohol, I was able to kind of explore a power greater than myself and start taking the steps. You know, and they used to be really hard on us back then. They would ask us things like, 10 minutes left. They would ask us things like, who's your sponsor? What step you on? I hated that. What meetings you going to? You know what I do now? Who's your sponsor? What step you on? What meetings you going to? But they would do things like that to us to keep us on task. And one time this old-timer, he kind of asked me, he said, what step you on, kid? And I thought I had my bases covered. I said, I did the third step out of the big book, said the prayer. He said, really? I said, really? I thought he would leave me alone at that point. But he said, why don't you get your big book and let's go read it together? And we read the third step prayer out of the big book, and he asked me to read the next paragraph, and it said, next. We launched on a course of vigorous action. And he looked me dead in the eye, and he said, what does next mean to you, son? Next week, next month, next drink. And I'm kind of ba 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 trying to backpedal. And he says, four-way stop, the other cars went.
That's what next means. And so I launched on that course of vigorous action, and I did that first inventory, which really kind of allowed me to start to see those things that blocked me from you and blocked me from God. So I took the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was relieved of that obsession and compulsion to drink. I met this lovely lady in my first year of sobriety. She, I think that she probably is an internal, an optimist, you know, because she saw a pile of manure and she says there's bound to be a pony in there somewhere. I mean, I'm living at Pathfinders. She was telling someone today, I was doing this boat work back then. She used to even like try to clean my hands, you know, for me. Okay, go right ahead. But, I was about 9 months sober. Gail was about 3 months sober, and they told us not to get into relationships. You know, but I went to San Diego City Schools, especially down here in Ocean Beach, and I know 9 months and 3 months equal 1 year. So, Gail, and what I did is in that instance, it's not a 13th step. When none of you have done any step work, it's not a 13th step. It's called a first and 12. Should I explain? A first and 12 is my life is unmanageable and I want to share it with her. And we had this crazy relationship that really didn't work. But what happened was, is eventually we had to kind of go our separate ways and grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous and take the steps. And, a couple years later, we ran into each other at a conference and we've been together dancing ever since. And, it's a pretty amazing thing. You know, I've really been blessed in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think I'd be, I've had good sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first guy that kind of helped me, I just had a guy that read the big book and kind of helped me take through the steps. But my first real sponsor was a guy by the name of Ron Wynn. And Ron Wynn was just a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a man that I've tried to model my life after, and I've really, really have not come close to following his footsteps. You know, and Ron Wynn was he was an African American man. He was a retired Navy chief, and he was a homosexual man. And if you'd have told me when I got here, a black ex-swabby gay guy is going to be the guy you're going to try to model your life after, I'd have told you you're crazy. But what he had is he had what I wanted, and how he carried himself as a man. And he taught me how to Greek. He helped me grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when he passed away when I was about 6 years sober, I just kind of slid into the arms of one of his best friends, a guy by the name of Peter Fleischman. And I can say his name at group level because they've gone to the meeting in the sky. You know, permanent sobriety. That's what those two guys died with. Permanent sobriety and dignity. That's how they died. And so I've had good sponsorship, you know. And if you're new, you know, I hope you find a good sponsor. And really this thing is as simple as monkey see, monkey do. Not monkey say, monkey do, because a lot of monkeys are going to say to do this and say to do that. But monkey see, monkey do. If you really want to know how I'm doing, ask Gail. You know, I mean, our book says that a greater demonstration of our principles lies in our homes, our occupations, and our affairs. Ask the people I work with. You know, ask the people down in my community that I live in today. How's Rob doing? You know. And Gail's had good sponsorship too, and we run into Michelle tonight. Gail's sponsor was a woman by the name of Corinne Cheney who died in the year 2000 with 50 years of sobriety. Think about a woman getting sober in 1950. You know, whenever people were telling her, you don't belong in this room, you need to go in the other room where the women are. She said, I'm an alcoholic, I'm not an Al-Anon. You know? So we've had great teachers in Alcoholics Anonymous and great mentors in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm forever indebted to those old-timers. I love those old-timers. I just love those old timers. I have so much respect for them. You know, they say the newcomer is the lifeblood of the program, but the old timer is the heart that beats the blood. And thank goodness there are people that have come before. You know, and I love to see these kids coming in today. I watch people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and get busy and watch their lives change. I've never not gone to meetings. I've never not been active in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just an easier, softer way for me. You know, Gail and I have been through a lot in sobriety. We've had a lot of amazing things. If I told you what our life was like today, you'd think I was bragging. You know, because I've been able to have an amazing life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's not so much what I have, but it's what I don't have. I don't have that awful ache in my heart anymore. I don't have that loneliness anymore. I don't have that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, you know, anymore. You know, but I've walked through some pain sober. I've walked, and I'm not one. I've heard it say, my best day, worst day sober is better than my best day drunk. I don't know what you are drinking. I had some, you know, because I've walked through a lot more pain in Alcoholics Anonymous than. And on Ron Wynn's deathbed, he said something to me. At the time, I thought he was delirious. He had a feeding tube in. We were pushing morphine into his feeding tube. He was on his way out. He was days from death. You know, we're changing his colostomy bag. It wasn't pretty. And we were just bringing meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous to his deathbed. And he'd kind of go in and out of consciousness. And one time he came to and he said, Robbie, I wish you lots of pain. And I thought, oh, man. Why? Because he knew that pain was a touchstone to all spiritual growth, like our basic text talks about. And he knew that if I could walk through life's trials and tribulations sober, with dignity, I'd grow closer to my Creator. And he was right. And we've been through a lot of pain. 2 minutes left. You know, I can follow directions. That's one thing I got taught early. You know, but we've lost sponsors, and we've lost parents, Gail and I we put off having kids and had a whole lot of fun trying. I sure like that trying. and it didn't work out too well. I told you that I grew up in Ocean Beach in the 70s, so. But we got real desperate and tried to go in vitro, and Gail lost two babies. And you stay sober through that. You know, you'll grow closer to your higher power. You'll grow closer to the fellowship. You'll grow closer to the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we've been through a lot of trials and tribulations because that's life. Life is life. But man, I've got some freedom today. You know, one of the things kind of going on in my life is a few years ago I was 1 minute left. A few years ago I was. I was in my office and I got a call out of the blue and someone asked me, is your name Rob Brockman? I said, yes. He says, were you born in La Jolla in 1961? I said, yes. He says, was your birth mother Monique Marzen? I said, well, that's what they tell me. He said, well, I knew your mother. I said, is she alive? He said, well, I think she's dead. And I said, okay, there we go again. Another letdown. But what I later found out is I had a brother and sister. And over the last few years, I've developed a relationship. My sister's husband has Parkinson's disease, and she needs a lot of help right now. My biological brother is going through a divorce, and he needs a lot of help right now. You know, I get to be a big brother today. You talked about being a grandma, and I get to be a big brother today. I'd guarantee you 24 years ago, if they'd have met me, they wouldn't want me in their life. And today, I'm the responsible one. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober. It's by far the best thing that's ever happened to me. You know, I really believe my sobriety is a gift. You know, I didn't earn it. I don't deserve it. And there's no way I could pay for it. It's priceless. And what I mean by I didn't earn it is, you know, I don't try to take offense to what anybody says, but I, when I, You know, I earned my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't earn my seat here. I was welcomed here when I wasn't welcome in dive bars in Ocean Beach. I was welcome here when people were not telling me to keep coming back. And all they ever said is, Rob, we're glad you're here. Keep coming back. So I didn't earn it. I don't deserve it. Thank gosh I didn't get what I deserved. I might have had a prison term. And there's no way I could pay for it. It's absolutely priceless. So how do I get to keep it? Old Dr. Bob says you got to pass it on. You know, somewhere in the, and I've been reading in our big book study something in either the family afterwards or to the employers, it talks about we get to mine a limitless load, provided we mine it for life and insist on giving the whole product away. So I hope you find if Alcoholics is not Anonymous is not working for you, try working for AA. Thanks.